same size. I'm an alcoholic. I was a little worried. I was, he was going to say I was heavy set or balding. Yeah. Big boned. Yeah, my name's Isaac. I'm an alcoholic. And that's one of the nicer introductions I've had. You know, and then they've gotten better the longer I've been sober. You should be like, oh, this is Isaac. He's going to be your client, you know, to the public defender. But, you know, as I said, I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July 30th, 1997. And I have a home group, you know, and I have a sponsor. And I always try to, you know, mention those things when I talk because those are the almost the bedrock or the foundation of my sobriety, you know. And because I'm not someone who came to AA and got sober right away. In fact, for several years I tried various 12-step programs, probably four or five different ones, you know. I had a lot of different problems, and but I never had a sobriety date, you know. Never had a sponsor, and never even heard of a home group, you know, until my sobriety this time. And what I'm going to do tonight is what I've been taught to do is try to share in a general way, you know, what I was like when I was drinking and then what happened to me and what I'm like today, you know. And before I start, let me just, you know, let you know that what I'm going to share is hopefully mostly my experience, probably sprinkled with some of my opinions. But, you know, it's my experience, you know, and I'm not an authority on AA. You know, I just know what's worked for me, you know. And for me to stand here, you know, I celebrated 10 years sober this summer, you know, with a couple of the guys I sponsor is, you know, is a testament to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And for me, you know, I've needed everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has. You know, it's the triangle. You know, I needed the fellowship, which is the unity, you know. I've needed the recovery, which is the service, which is the steps, and I've needed the service. You know, and those three things, you know, people talk about balance. You know, they're looking for balance in their lives. You know, and I think if there's anything to balance, it's those three things. You know, because, you know, I've seen people stay sober, you know, and I've experienced staying sober just on the fellowship, and that generally gets uncomfortable. And I've also experienced, you know, being really involved in service, staying sober on that, you know, and not really doing any looking at myself, and that'll be later in my story. And, you know, I almost drank again, you know. And so I think that for me, you know, recovery is, you know, that bottom central foundation, and then I need the service and the unity, you know, to kind of keep me in line. But, you know, in a general way, let me say this, you know, this is kind of nice. Whenever I speak at my home group back at home, there's a big clock in the podium, you know, and that clock is a direct result of the first time that I shared at my home group, because, you know, I ended with a standing ovation, and it wasn't because my talk was so good. It was because we were 15 minutes past closing, and I still had probably 5 years of drinking, you know. So today, you know, I'll try not to, you know, bore you with a long drunkalogue, you know. But, you know, I got here, you know, through a lot of drinking, you know, and I did other stuff that, you know, kind of speeded things up for me towards the end. But, you know, I grew up in a good family, you know, a very religious family. In Wheaton, which is right outside, it's in Montgomery County, right outside D.C., you know, and I'm the oldest of three children. You know, my parents are still together. You know, we grew up with, my parents were immigrants, so there wasn't, you know, it wasn't like we had a lot, but we had enough, you know. I never went to bed hungry, you know. I grew up with, you know, a good values, you know, a good work ethic, you know, do well in school, you know, be good to your friends, you know, say your prayers at night. Actually, you know, it was very religious, so I said my prayers morning, afternoon, evening. And, you know, but I was the type of kid that got in a lot of trouble, you know. Not like, you know, I hear some of my other friends' stories, and it wasn't like I was doing vandalism and, you know, stealing cars and stuff when I was 11 years old. You know, but really, at an early age, I was the class clown, you know. I was a guy that acted out, you know, 39 years old, and so I remember, you know, I was, you know, digital watches came out when I was in school, in elementary school, and I was the guy that would get everybody to set their watch to get the alarm to go off like a minute apart, you know. And when I was the guy that would shoot spitballs, you know, when the teacher's back was turned, or just whatever it was, passing notes. So I got kicked out of class all the time, you know, to the point that, you know, by second grade, actually, I had to repeat second grade because I'd been, missed so many classes. And so not that that makes me an alcoholic, but just that wasn't comfortable, you know. In sixth grade, you know, I got sent to psychiatrists because I got in a physical altercation with a teacher. You know, the teacher won, and I got expelled, and I hadn't had a drink yet, you know, I was just, you know, still acting out, you know, and I got sent to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, you know, we had family therapy, everybody had to go, you know, and after about a month of this, they were like, okay, we, you know, nobody else needs to go, just Isaac needs to keep coming, and they basically told my parents that, you know, it was almost like I was a victim. You know, the idea was put into my head that the reason I acted out and I was a class clown is because I had a little brother and a sister, and they took the attention away from me as the oldest, and as such, I was just seeking any sort of attention, negative or positive. It didn't make a difference. And I was like, makes sense, you know? But didn't change anything about my behavior. You know, I still got in a lot of trouble, you know? And, you know, I had my first drink. And a lot of what I'm going to share tonight is kind of looking back in hindsight. I mean, I could have told you this when I was newly sober. But I had my first drunk. I remember getting drunk when having a drink once or twice when I was a kid at family's, you know, somebody's wedding or, you know, my uncle's bar mitzvah or something like that. But my first time I really got drunk was I turned 13. I was Jewish and had my bar mitzvah, and my mom was a caterer, and we did it in my backyard with a big tent. Had a big open bar in the basement, and my friends were all like, I don't remember, they were having like daiquiris and, you know, pina coladas, you know, and I knew intuitively, and in retrospect, I kind of remember some, you know, some stuff, but I knew intuitively I didn't want a fruity drink. You know, I wanted a whiskey sour, you know, or a screwdriver, and that's what I had, you know, and I got drunk, and I didn't decide that night that that's what I wanted to do the rest of my life, you know, that I was going to aspire to be an alcoholic and, you know, end up on the streets of New York and, you know, alienate all my family and friends and, you know, be, you know, basically, you know, panhandle, you know, that's where I ended up. But I just knew that I really, you know, felt like I was always so tightly wound like a spring. And I felt like I could be myself when I was drunk, you know. And we ran around the neighborhood and, you know, caused some minor trouble and, you know, no consequences, you know, no consequences. And looking back, I kind of remember, you know, I remember when I grew up, you know, when it was in the 70s where I was drinking, my parents, you know, they were pretty, you know, normal, down-to-earth people, but they would have parties, like, once in a while. And I just have this memory of being a kid and looking through the banister, you know, I'd go down the stairs and sneak down in the basement, and, you know, they were normally, like, very kind of proper, uptight type of people, and it seemed like, you know, they were drinking downstairs, people were drinking, people were having a good time, you know, and that stuck somewhere in the back of my head, you know, and so over the next several years, you know, on the outside, you know, things were up and down. So I'd gotten in a lot of trouble, you know, all the way through ninth grade, but by ninth grade, you know, I started to drink pretty regularly, you know, because I was the guy who had access. You know, my mom had a closet in the basement, you know, two-door closet that wasn't locked, you know, that was full of liquor. She was, you know, she was the caterer in the neighborhood. And not good liquor. You know, I don't know if you've ever drank, like, Manischewitz, you know. We had a lot of, like, kosher wines and liquors and stuff like that. And over the next couple of years, you know, I ended up going from, you know, the more I drank, kind of the better I started actually to do in school. I got involved in athletics. I played a bunch of different sports. You know, I should qualify that by saying there were 11 kids in my high school graduating class, so it wasn't that difficult to make the teams, you know. But I started, you know, I was outgoing, you know, I had a lot of friends. I started doing really well academically, you know, and at the same time, you know, I drank, you know, whenever I could. And, you know, drinking was, you know, in the woods, you know, or we'd go on a retreat, you know, supposed to be kind of getting in touch with our spirituality, and I'd bring a case of whatever it was, and a bunch of us would get drunk and spray shaving cream all over the principal while he was asleep, and, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, by the time I was 18, they changed the drinking laws. You had to be 21. But I was old enough, since I had repeated second grade, and that, you know, I was 18 when I was a senior, and I got grandfather clause into drinking, and into getting, you know, I got an ID. Actually, I had several IDs, and me and all my friends would go out, you know, and we'd go to the bars in Georgetown. And, you know, this in retrospect, I can see clearly this is kind of where I crossed the line. And I've crossed many lines, you know, but this is kind of the line, you know, it talks about in the big book, you know, we drink, alcoholics drink for the effect produced by alcohol. You know, and I remember I went out that night, and it was a bar in Georgetown, and they served beer in these goblets that were almost like little fish bowls. You know, I had 10 of those drinks. It was down on the waterfront, 10 beers, and I was by far and away the most sober person. I drove home that night, you know, I drove my friends home, almost got in a lot of trouble. I mean, I literally almost T-boned a police officer and just ended up, you know, driving off home, and you know, didn't get in any trouble, but I made the conscious decision that night, you know, and some of my friends at home make fun of me for this. Is not bad-mouthing beer, you know. I like beer, you know. But I drank for the effect, and beer didn't have the effect that I got from hard liquor. You know, so I made a conscious decision that I just, you know, I'm going to drink hard liquor if ever, you know, if I ever have a choice between beer and hard liquor, it's going to be hard liquor. And I stuck to that choice, you know, for the next, you know, 11 years, you know. And I was 18 years old. I didn't know really what I wanted to do after high school. And, you know, I thought, you know, I knew I was going off to college. I was actually going off to seminary, you know. I was going to try to go to medical school and, you know, studying possibly to be a rabbi. And I'd grown up really religious. And, you know, I went off to live in Jerusalem for a year and study. And, you know, it was like the training wheels came off, you know. I don't know, 8,000 miles away with no real supervisory authority, with, you know, 150 other 18, 19, 20-year-old guys, you know, in a country where liquor is cheaper than gasoline, you know, so, and there's no drinking age. And, you know, that was when I started to, you know, get a little bit of a reputation, you know. Still kind of a mixture of the class clown and the drunk, you know. But, you know, I had alcohol poisoning several times, you know, and, you know, talks in the big book about getting tight at exactly the wrong time. You know, like the night before my family came to visit me, I hadn't seen them in like 6 months. You know, I'm the type of guy that if you go chug, 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 I will chug it, whatever it is. And that night it was a gallon of Smirnoff's vodka, you know, and I probably got about half of it down. My friends thought it'd be fun to take me into town, you know, and, you know, see what I would do. And they were drunk, too. You know, and the school was at the bottom of a steep hill. So they took me up to the top of the hill. We were going to catch the bus. And I mean, I just passed out, you know. And they were drunk. I was passed out. And they didn't know what to do. So they, you know, they went down to the kitchen, got a food service cart, put me on there, started to wheel me down the hill. I don't know whatever happened, but, you know, they didn't hold on to the cart, you know. And I woke up the next morning, you know, having to go meet my parents at the airport at 7 a.m., you know, with like, what's wrong? Like, why do I hurt? You know, and I had like gravel embedded into me and had the dinner from the night before, you know, in my hair, you know, and it was a funny story, you know. You know, I'd already started to black out by then, you know, and, you know, I came back and I moved to New York, you know, I went to college. It was a religious college where I was pursuing both, you know, secular studies and religious studies. And, you know, as I said, I grew up really sheltered in the sense that, you know, I never saw, you know, any drugs or anything growing up. In New York, you know, it's like a kid in a candy shop, you know. I mean, if you thought it was easy to go drinking in D.C., you know, with IDs, you know, from, you know, saying that I was, you know, 18 years old and allowed to drink in New York, no, as long as you put the money on the bar, they didn't care, you know. And I started off school with all these ambitions. You know, I was started off with a really high GPA. I was doing really well. And I was going to go to medical school. And sometime probably between my first and second semester, you know, I started discovering, you know, other stuff to do, you know. And I'm an alcoholic, you know, garden variety alcoholic. And, You know, I'm not different than any other alcoholic, but I definitely did a lot of drugs. I won't talk a lot about them in AA, but, you know, I basically was introduced to smoking marijuana, you know, and I didn't take to it right away, so I continued to do it daily for the next 7 years until it kind of really started to work for me. And pretty soon, like, you know, an average day would be, you know, I'd get up and smoke some marijuana and I'd watch some Discovery Channel. I learned how to cook in college, not through anything other than smoking a lot of pot and watching a lot of cable TV, you know. And I'd take a nap and I'd get up and I'd play some computer golf on the computer, and then I'd go out drinking to the Irish pubs, you know. And there was a period where I tried going out to the trendy bars and meeting people, you know, and meeting people never worked for me. So it's like, you know, after a while, I was like, I'm just going to hang with the guys, go to the 70, you know, go to the Irish pub on the 79th and Broadway, you know, the Dublin House, because, you know, you could get a shot, you know, or several shots and a pitcher of beer for like $10, you know, and, I mean, I was about to drink it. Really wasn't into the whole social thing, you know, and I wasn't even into, like, drinking games, just, like, drink. I don't know the point. I didn't see the point, you know. Why do you have to bounce a quarter into something? I want a drink. I'm going to have a drink, you know. And I didn't need any kind of justification. And pretty soon, you know, I wasn't quite seeking out lower companions at this point in time, but I was kind of the people that weren't doing what I was doing slowly got phased out of my life, you know. And just, you know, the people that I used to study with, you know. I was a vice president of the Pre-Med Honor Society, you know, all that kind of stuff. I just stopped going. Eventually stopped going to class, you know. And, you know, I went from a, you know, a 3.6 student and an honor student to like a 0.2. You know, and I didn't pass a single class my senior year. You know, I'd been accepted to medical school at the end of my junior year. And the end of my senior year, I had zero credits from that year. So they didn't want me in medical school. And, walked down the aisle, collected my diploma, you know, got my presents from my family, and they found out about a year later that, you know, I was still 40 credits short of graduating college. And but they were, you know, they were down here and I was in New York, so they didn't really see a lot of what was going on. You know, and then over the next couple of years, you know, the disease really progressed, you know. I had this job, you know, I have a history of, like, you know, I'm a good starter. A lot of alcoholics are good starters. I got a prestigious job, you know, working, doing medical research at Columbia University. And I don't know how long I did the job for, but I did it for a while. And it's, I never quit. I just stopped going, you know. You know, at this point in time, I started to have some consequences, you know. I remember it was 1987, you know, it was a, you know, I used to like to go to listen to jazz music or blues music, and I'd get really messed up, you know, either before or during or after, but all the time. You know, I remember we came back at 3 in the morning, and the school I lived in was in a really, really bad neighborhood. It was Spanish Harlem, Washington Heights. And I ended up, it was 3 in the morning, we got back, and I wasn't done. So I wanted to go, you know, score some stuff, and, you know, we got held up. You know, crack cocaine had just come out. It was like a, I don't know, fashionable thing to do back then, to just have nothing but a trench coat and a shotgun and walk around and hold up people. You know, because it happened all the time, and it happened to me and two of my friends. And, you know, one of my friends, you know, quit partying that night. You know, that was it, last time. Next one started going to therapy. You know? I had a shotgun put in my mouth, you know, for like $2, you know, gave him everything I had. And I was at the same spot the next night. You know, it was just like a price you had to pay, you know. And, you know, so in the next couple of years, you know, stuff started to happen, you know. I got this amazing opportunity, you know. I started waiting tables, you know, and through a family connection, a family friend, I got this job in the garment business, which allowed me to travel all over the world, you know. And they paid me a ton of money. You know, I was a big shot, had the corporate card, and stayed in five-star hotels, and flew first class. And one problem is they kept sending me to Southeast Asia, you know. And I picked up some bad habits in Southeast Asia. And, you know, started doing some of the harder drugs, you know. And, you know, my, it was a big secret. Nobody knew. you know, and I was constantly drinking. You know, I'd be in the bar, you know, at the hotel, you know, just put it on the tab, you know. And no longer was it a social thing where I went out with the guys, you know. It was a drink by myself in the bar, you know, or drink by myself in the hotel room. And I put myself in some crazy situations, you know, to the point where, you know, I was bringing a lot of contraband with me every time I went on a business trip, you know. They'd give me, you know, $1,000 cash in addition to the corporate card before every trip, so I could buy presents for the people, the clients that we might do business with, and I'd spend $20 on a carton of cigarettes and $980 on stuff I needed to not get sick when I was there, and invariably, you know, I'd run out, you know, and I'd try to drink myself into a stupor, you know, just so I didn't go into withdrawal, and I tried to quit, you know, I tried to quit so many times, you know. At this point, I thought my problem was just drugs. You know, if I could just stop doing heroin, everything would be okay, you know, because it was starting to affect my performance at work and all these lines that I had drawn in the sand, you know, like, you know, I'm never going to steal from my family, you know, I'm never going to miss work for partying, I'm never going to get messed up at work. All of those gone out the window, you know, and they offered me help. You know, it was a small family-run company. And they had a family member that had been kind of through what I had been through. And they approached me several times. Like, you know, we want to help you. What do you? And I just, I don't have a problem. I don't know what you're talking about, you know. And they fired me eventually because I would, they'd pay probably $10,000 for a ticket for me to fly overseas. And I'd be gone 2 days. I'd just be gone for 3 weeks and I'd fly back home. You know, just be like, come up with some crazy story, you know. And the second time I did it, you know. You know, they're like, we can't, you know, you're actually hurting the company, and, you know, we want to help you, but, you know, we can't help you, and today, you know, I made my amends for that, you know, but for a long time, I was really ashamed to see any of those people, because they're friends of my relatives in New York, but, you know, over the next couple of years, you know, I became a low-bottom alcoholic, you know, I had this idea in my head of who I was, which really didn't match the outside. You know, I was the pre-med student. You know, I was a college, almost college graduate. You know, I was a research scientist, you know. But in reality, you know, I couldn't even hold a job down waiting tables, you know. In reality, you know, I'm a guy that, you know, the consequences started happening. You know, I'd been arrested for possession and spent 72 hours in a place called the Tombs, you know, central booking in lower Manhattan, and I got out, you know, and I swore I would never do this again, and I didn't stay sober a day, you know, and I ended up in a disagreement with a, how should I put it, it was a business transaction that went bad, you know, and this little kid that's about this big, you know, pistol whipped me and put me in the hospital for 18 days, you know, he fractured my jaw, and then I issued what they, these are now called terroristic threats. I guess if you threaten to get even with a weapon, that's a terroristic threat. And they put me in the psych ward, and, you know, my parents came to visit me, and I had this vivid memory of me yelling at my dad. You know, I mean, that was, I'd had surgery, like 7 hour surgery to fix my jaw, and they put me back in the psych ward, and, you know, my dad was on one side of the glass doors, I was on the other, and I was yelling how it was all his fault, you know, and he was crying. And after 18 days, I got out and didn't stay sober a day again. You know, so I was really and truly powerless, you know. And then at this point, I think it was around then when I first was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometime around 1994, you know, I decided I was going to detox, you know, because I'd gotten on methadone trying to, you know, fix myself and ended up, you know, just blacking out every day. You know, I drank, I'd take the methadone, I'd pop some pills, whatever people had in the park, and, you know, it was, every day was the same, you know. And it was on welfare, I couldn't even show up to pick up my welfare stamp, my food stamps, and my welfare check, and, you know, I'd been making six figures a year earlier, you know. I lost my place to live, you know, my parents came and they thought it was where I lived, the neighborhood was the problem, and they came to move me out and they found, you know, my cousin's credit card in my apartment. You know, And, you know, the rest of my, that was it. The family was done, you know. Cause I guess the year earlier, I don't remember this, but as I was told, you know, there's, we do like Passover, it's kind of like Christmas, you know, and the whole family's together at my grandmother's, you know, 35 people, and, you know, they wait for me, and they wait for me, and eventually they start, because, you know, they know I'm not going to show up. And I show up about like 4 hours late, in a blackout, you know, and they go to feed me some food, and I just pass out with my, you know, face literally in the plate, you know, and everybody's screaming, so... You know, so I knew I had a problem, you know, and I went to detox, you know, every intention of staying sober, you know, but I'm powerless, you know. I didn't stay sober again 24 hours, you know, and the next year and a half was incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I was arrested several times for panhandling, you know. If I knew you at some point in time, you know, I would call you and ask you to Western Union me money, you know, if we went to high school together, if you were my rabbi at some point in time or teacher, you know, and no one, you know, I wasn't sleeping on the streets. I was, you know, I still had a few people that would allow me to, you know, crash on their sofa or something like that. And eventually even that ended, you know, and, you know, this guy that I knew for 30 years of my life, you know. You know, I was sleeping on his sofa, and I think he caught me stealing from him. You know, and, he gave me a couple $100 and said, I love you, but I can't watch you kill yourself. I don't ever want to see you again. And, you know, the only people that would have me, you know, were my parents, you know. You know, I had warrants out for my arrest. You know, I was 120 pounds, you know. I actually tried to get sober the year before I came home. You know, I'd been in like a three-year relationship where it finally came out, you know, that I was doing all this other stuff and was stealing from her and stealing from her roommates. And in 1997, in July, you know, April, you know, my parents, everybody knew better than to send me money, you know, but they bought me a one-way ticket home, you know, and... I had missed court the week before. You know, I was fully planning on going. You know, it was just a minor thing. But I had stayed up all night partying, and I was just too paranoid. You know, I was the type of guy that... I was renting a room from... this isn't really a smart thing to do, but the woman was a retired cop with two retired police dogs, you know? And I was renting a room, you know, and there were these blue Dobermans that were almost as big as me. Yeah, and I'm not sleeping for 4 or 5 days at a time. You know, completely paranoid. You know, half the money I'm spending is I'm buying steaks to give the dogs because I'm so sure that they're going to come and attack me because they can definitely sniff, like, the stuff that I'm doing. And I thought the cops had periscopes and had, like, this whole mirror system where they could see into the window where I was. So I had a jug where I would that I would use to the bathroom, you know. And I had, and I would just party, actually, in the closet, you know, with the door closed. So I wasn't in good shape, you know. But my life seemed normal, you know. It was just, I didn't hang out with anybody that didn't do that kind of stuff. Actually, even the kind of people that I partied with, they were able to kind of at least have a place to live, you know. And so they wouldn't even have me around. So I moved back here. I got a bus. It was around April 1st, 97. And, you know, my parents took me in. I was 120 pounds. I was delusional. You know, I thought I was good. I thought I looked good, you know, because I thought, man, I got my abs, they're showing, you know what I'm saying? And it was my ribs. And I was like, I'm going to be a dancer. You know, I'm going to make some money. And, my sponsor usually makes me tell that story. It's the same person, but, you know, the outsides are different. But, you know, and one of the things my parents had me do is they had me go to, like, an outpatient rehab type place. And I'd never been, you know. And they taught me a lot about alcoholism and drug addiction. And I never, I still hadn't accepted that I was an alcoholic, you know. I thought, I'm just a drug addict, you know. And my experiences, and both my own personal and from having watched people, is that, and this isn't my thought, this is something I've heard someone say, but it applies to me, is that the thing that kills most alcoholics is that feeling of difference. You know, my case is different. You know, you just don't understand. And I had that, you know. My case was different because, you know, the religion I grew up in, or the education I had, or the neighborhood I lived in, or my parents' situation, or the traveling I had done, or the fact that I was a drug addict, not an alcoholic, or I was an alcoholic and not a drug addict. You know, and as long as I was different, I didn't have to do what everybody else did. You know, I did not have to get a sponsor. Didn't have to work the steps. Certainly didn't have to believe in God, because God and I parted paths in seminary, you know. I'd become like an outspoken atheist, you know. But what happened was God, the grace came into my life. You know, I believe that my sobriety, and this is just my belief, you know, I believe that, you know, the fact that I was, that came back to AA, and that, you know, I was given sobriety, and the obsession was lifted, was a gift of my higher power. You know, I also firmly believe that my higher power has gotten me here, but it's my responsibility and the actions I take in sobriety that guarantee or give me a shot at continuing my sobriety. That's just my belief, my experience, you know. I don't believe that if I just have faith and I don't do the right thing, that I'm gonna stay sober, you know, because I have experience of having compulsions at 5 years sober from living unprincipled, you know. But what happens is I fell into a home group that was an active group. It's a lot smaller than it is now. You know, it's probably like 50 or 60 people, you know, but I had nothing to do, you know. I was sitting at home. I'd go to rehab, you know. I'd come home. I'd go through my dad's medicine cabinet. He's a pharmacist. He just has a giant bottle of pills. But that a PDR, physician assessed reference, and I'd go through and find, okay, that's got this, and, you know, that's got that, and take a couple of those and a couple of shots of scotch and pop in a, you know, Apocalypse Now. I'd, you know, black out watching that every day after rehab. You know, and then get up and I'd go to the meeting, you know, because that's where I met people. And eventually, you know, they kind of just stopped, you know. I actually got sober, you know, but the obsession wasn't lifted. So I had admitted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, you know. I still thought about getting messed up every day, you know. And I knew that, you know, I was 29 years old. I was living in my parents' basement, didn't have a job, and I knew where the liquor was. You know, it was right downstairs, you know. And what happened for me is that it was suggested that I not take certain actions by a sponsor. I got a temporary sponsor. It still happened today. You know, it's almost 10 and a half years. And he asked me if I could take some direction. And I said, I work better with suggestions. You know, he said, well, he said, this is a yes or no question. You know, and I said, you know, I'll try my best. And but in July, sometime in July, you know, I went on a family trip with my aunt and uncle and my parents and my cousins up to Canada, you know, upstate New York and Canada, and then came back down. And on a Saturday night, you know, they lived in Brooklyn, and I had my ex-girlfriend that I hadn't seen, you know, in a couple of months. And we'd still been talking. And, you know, I went to go visit her, you know, and decided to go out to dinner. And she asked me if it would bother me if she had a glass of wine. I said, no. Do what you want, you know. Big Book says, you know, absolutely, you know, don't tell our friends not to drink. And I was really uncomfortable. And after dinner, you know, we went to go listen to some jazz music. And it was back in the old neighborhood, you know. And I could see, you know, the guys that had the stuff I really wanted were just probably about as far away across the street as the door over there. And she knew I was uncomfortable. She said, why don't you have a non-alcoholic beer? And this is the insanity of the second step, in my opinion, you know. It's not the fact that I've been to the psych ward and that they wrote, like, that I have all these potential problems, you know, manic depressive, bipolar, borderline personality disorder, homicidal, suicidal. I mean, they put all sorts of labels. And they also said possible alcoholism, you know. But that's not what makes me crazy. What makes me crazy is the insanity is the thinking that I have. Which is, the thought that came into my mind was, I know there's no such thing as a non-alcoholic beer. I've been around AA long enough to know There's alcohol in there. But nothing bad ever happened to me from one beer. So I had a beer. And nothing bad happened. So I had another beer. You know? Nothing bad happened. So I had some scotch. And like 8 scotches later, you know, I'm blacking out. I'm caught trying to steal money from her pocketbook so I can score some stuff to help me drink the rest of the night. You know? And I woke up the next morning, you know, and I don't know if I did all 3 steps or anything like that. You know, the first 3 steps. I knew that I was powerless. And I knew that I needed a higher power. You know? And I didn't get honest about it right away. You know? But after, probably when I had like 9 months sober, or 6 months sober, I was supposed to have to pick up a 9-month chip. And I didn't. You know? And I kept going to the bathroom. I was sitting next to my sponsor when we went to get out chips. Finally, he's like, what's... You know, why don't you want to pick up a chip? It's like, you know, I told half the truth. Yeah, you know, I said, you know, well, I sniffed some Benadryl and I'm not really sure about my sobriety. And that was true, but it was also true that I drank, you know, and eventually that came out. And since then, you know, my life's taken off, you know. I remember the first time I went a day without thinking about drinking. You know, I was at the beach. You know, I was cooking dinner for a bunch of people after we spent the day on the beach. We're all in the program. We're going to cook dinner, eat dinner together, go to the meeting. It was with my sponsor, my grand sponsor. And it just hit me like I haven't thought about drinking all day. It had been at least 10 years since I had a day like that. And I thought, I was hopeless, you know. When I came into AA, well into AA, I thought, this might work for you. But I still think about drinking all the time. You know, and I can't take it. And that day was it was a beautiful day, you know. And it came through being of service, you know. And shortly thereafter, I did my 4 step, you know. And my experience is that, well, I'd been in and out of AA before, you know, and I'd never stayed sober. I'd never done a 4 step, you know, and I did a 4 step with my sponsor. And I had some secrets I was planning on leaving off, you know. There were some stuff I was going to go to the grave with, you know, some stuff that happened even before I started drinking, you know. And a guy that helped me a lot, who's no longer around, was driving me home one night, and he shared his experience about leaving some secrets off his 4 step, you know, and how he went out one night, 9 months sober, you know, he cashed a paycheck, he went out to go to the store to buy some underwear, and came to in a dumpster 3 days later, you know, with no money left. You know, and he encouraged me to make a plan to tell my sponsor these secrets even before I did my 5th step. And I did that. I made the plan that night, you know. And then the next morning, you know, I changed my mind. I was like, I'm not telling this guy this stuff. But I made the plan, and I went through with it, you know, and I told him this stuff. And he didn't judge me. You know, we were at a going away party for, actually, my now brother-in-law. You know, and he was getting ready. He was sober. He was getting ready to move out to the West Coast and walk down the block and told my sponsor this stuff. And he shared some similar experiences. And the rest of the 5th step was pretty, you know, it was pretty petty Annie stuff, you know, except for the stuff that I put on there that wasn't exactly, I exaggerated, you know, like I put down that I had a hit put out on somebody, you know, and I wasn't that type of guy. I was a guy that someone said, hey, do you want me to get this guy for you? I was gonna be like, yeah, and that turned into like, you know, so I lied on my 4th step, and but I also told all the truth as much as I could, and there was no white light, there was no, you know, it wasn't like all the weight of the world was lifted off my shoulders. What happened was I felt comfortable with my sponsor, and I could tell him anything, you know, because he didn't judge me, you know, and he didn't spread this stuff around. That I heard it coming back to me from somebody else, you know. And what he tried to do, and I tried to do, when I hear a 5th step, is try to point, see the patterns in people's lives. And I saw the pattern in my life, which is I'm a victim. My life, if only these people acted right, this wouldn't have happened, you know. And looking at the 5th step, I saw I had a part. I always put myself in that position to be hurt through my attitude or my actions. You know, in some way I put myself, and I still do that today, you know, when I even put expectations on people, you know. getting in a relationship, and you know, someone's going to step on your toes, you know, or you're going to have expectations of how they're supposed to be, you know, and this is premeditated resentment, you know, and I still do it, but I'm aware of it, you know, and I went on and did the 6 and 7 step, which is an ongoing thing, you know, and it goes back to, you know, what I shared about, like, the higher power in my concept of God, which is that, you know, I ask God for help with whatever problem. It's not just problems that are making me uncomfortable or that are getting me in trouble. It's whatever stands in the way of my usefulness to Him and others around me, you know. Because who knows, you know, some of the stuff that I've had problems with, I've had to have that for a long time because now I can share that experience with people that I sponsor. That was a huge mess financially. I hadn't paid the IRS in years, hadn't paid taxes, hadn't paid, you know, my visa in years. I mean, just a big mess. And now, you know, through that defect, you know, I actually get to help a lot of people. Some people follow through quickly, some people slowly. But, we're getting there. You know, so I don't know, you know, and I still, stuff crops up, you know. And for me, the real turning points this week was kind of the 8th and 9th step. You know, I came to believe in a higher power, actually, through doing my amends. You know, I had a long list, and the easy ones were the financial, you know, because, you didn't really have to face the people. You could write them a letter, you know. And, you know, the first, I was very numb. The first feeling I had in sobriety was guilt and shame. Because I had stolen, borrowed, pawned, whatever it was. It didn't matter who you were. My parents, you know, my brother and sister, girlfriend, roommates, you know. And it was interesting. I got this job because, you know, I turned 30. My mom was like, you got to get out of the house and get a job, you know. Just, I was just sitting on there like, well, I'm sober. You know, and they're like, no, go get a job. And I still have the same job today. You know, it's been just about 10 years. And, but it was really weird. These people paid me quarterly in advance with no taxes taken out. So I was making $28,000 a year, which is not a lot. But it was 1997, and I got a check for $7,000. Yeah. I was living at home. You know, I had a car. I had no, you know what I'm saying? I had no expenses, you know. So I sat down with my sponsor. We made a list. And I wrote checks that night, you know, to like 12 people, you know, and I either paid them off or started off with individuals first, you know, and family and individuals, and then eventually, you know, institutions, and then finally the IRS. And pretty quickly I was out of debt, you know, and that I just would write a letter that would basically say, you know, this is, you know, what I'm trying to live. He didn't say I was in AA. He said, I'm just trying to live a spiritual way of life. I'm in recovery, you know, and one of the things I need to do is make right the things I did wrong. And, you know, one of the things I did is I stole, borrowed, whatever it was, and, you know, I'm trying to make it right. Here's a check, you know. And amazing things started to happen to me. You know, the guy that had kicked me out that I'd known for like 25, 30 years, you know, giving me some money, said, I don't ever want to see you again, you're killing yourself. You know, I made amends to him just through letters. And went back to visit New York, and I had like 2 years sober, and I was wandering around Central Park, and I ran into him. You know, it's a city of 8 million people. You know, and we started to talk. He had gotten the letter, he got the check. You know, he asked how I was doing. And then several months later, I ran into him in Union Station. You know, and he was down for something that was going on in D.C. And I'm not a big miracle guy. You know, I still struggle with, you know, the God of my understanding, you know, because I have a lot of old ideas about the, you know, the way I grew up. And but that kind of stuff would happen kind of on a regular basis, you know. So I started making those amends. I did the financial amends, and then I moved into making direct amends with my family and my relatives, you know, and there's only one person out there still, you know, it's the two. One is a guy that I used to party with that actually tried a 12-step. And I have been looking for him for probably the last 8 years. I haven't found him. And the other one is, you know, my ex-girlfriend. And it was one of those my sponsor kind of suggested that I leave that alone. And it doesn't really come up often, but when it does, it's like I know that there's unfinished business. So, I went through my amends, and the promises came through, you know, quickly, you know. the new freedom and new happiness. I started with the living amends by just helping when I was living at my parents' house, do the dishes, mow the lawn, fold the laundry, just try to be a giver, not a taker, and to try to not take credit for it, and eventually the face-to-face amends. And he gave me a very simple formula, if it's not going to hurt them, and run it by your sponsor first, this is what I did wrong, what can I do to make it right? And then the 10 steps been a struggle, and that got me in a lot of trouble, 5 years sober, I was very active in my home group, I was active in the area, I was involved in the area intergroup, and I got the gifts of sobriety, and sometimes those are dangerous, I'd gotten in a relationship with a girl who'd been sober a long time, still active, still, we're married now, and I was still going to meetings every day. I was sponsoring people. I'd bought a house, which was kind of just a crazy thing for a homeless guy, And even more ironic, it was like 3 miles from my parents' house, and I swore, when I was growing up, I do not want to live near my family, But I started to use people in AA, I'd have new people over, and I'd feed them, but they would paint, or they'd do yard work. Or whatever it was. And I still go to meetings, but I went to the meetings to find out who can come help me, And this guy that I respect a lot, who I think spoke down here, this guy Jack, came up to me one weekend on the beach and said, you're going to have a beautiful house with absolutely nobody to come visit you if you don't change, And then my grand sponsor came up to me before I was speaking at the meeting that night in my home group. And he said, do you want to start sticking, do you like sticking needles in your arm? I was like, no, not anymore. He's like, well, that's where you're headed. And then it hit me, And I had a compulsion to drink around that time. I went 3 days without a meeting. It was a big snowstorm. I was with my family, and just, things were just crazy around me. And I just thought, I know what takes us all away. And it had been years since I had that. And that was probably one of the most dangerous points in my sobriety. And another thing that I've experienced, and it's not something I'm proud of, but I got very involved in the area level service. When I was new, my sponsor was the guy that would go to the intergroup and carry the literature and sell the literature, and I'd carry the books for him. And eventually, I became part of the intergroup and did various different committees. And then one day, they're having elections and nobody was standing up, so I was like, I'll run. And I got on the executive committee, and then the co-chair, and eventually I was the chair of the intergroup and did D.C. area, and I think I did a lot of good for the AA in our area, in the hospitals, institutions, and, our annual gala, and a lot of stuff like that, but my recovery was just, because my sponsor didn't really, I'm the area, I'm the chair, what I'm saying? I'm doing a lot of good stuff, and I don't need to look at myself. It's not that it was conscious thoughts, but that's just the actions that happened, I started thinking, I got to get a new sponsor, a sponsor with my, pedigree, who's done the type of stuff that I do. And it's just like an uncomfortable period, because I firmly believe that I'm not immune from drinking, My concept of a higher power, this is just mine, is that if I live by the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, I will lead a comfortable life, If I don't, my life gets uncomfortable. When I get uncomfortable, that's when I think about drinking, through doing a 10 step, when I do it, staying current with my sponsor, he has the opportunity to kind of point out the stuff to me before the seat gets too hot, And he suggested I get back into prayer and meditation. Because I had a bad attitude about that, I was not going to get down on my knees and pray to God. And I firmly believe in prayer today. When I first came to AA this time and my sponsor said, get down on your knees and pray to God, I said, cut off both my legs at the knees. Would not get down on those stumps and pray to God. I believe in God. And today I pray every day. Thank God for my sobriety, at night, asking for help in the morning, during the course of the day when I'm disturbed. before I get up to speak. And my experience is that my prayers have not changed external circumstances. You know, if it's rainy and I want it to be sunny and I pray, it doesn't change. You know, if someone has cancer and they're sick and I pray, it doesn't change. You know, what does happen is something inside me changes. My level of acceptance of the situation changes. Because I've had identical situations happen where sometimes I pray and sometimes I don't. Nothing's changed on the outside. Sometimes I'm totally okay with it, sometimes I'm not. And it's when I pray about it that I accept whatever it is, you know. And then finally the 12th step, you know, which is that, it's not just, I get into two-stepping, you know. Stay sober, go to meetings, set up, do service, sponsor guys, talk to, you know. But, you know, that's 10, 6, and 7. You know, that's where I go when I get uncomfortable, you know. Looking at myself, trying to pray about it, sit, and then, you know, have the opportunity to not react instinctively. So my natural response is to lash out, you know. Which, you know, is, you know, we've only got a couple minutes left. I'm just going to talk a little bit more about the traditions, but, you know, as I said, I'm kind of long-winded in my story. But, you know, I've had opportunities, you know, where I felt attacked personally. I felt my groups attacked, you know, and I've really, really thrown myself into traditions, you know. Knowing that unity is the most important thing. Because without that unity, we don't have the meetings. Without the meetings, you know, I don't have my sobriety. Because I know for myself, I've tried many a time, you know, to try to get sober on my own. And never been successful. You know, trying to be self-supporting, which is not just, you know, me paying my way, you know, but I heard someone share once about self-supporting emotionally, mentally, spiritually, where I'm not looking for something on the outside to fix me, you know. When my wife's not acting right, you know, I need to be okay on my own. You know, we've been trying to get pregnant for a couple of years. It hasn't worked out. You know, been through a couple of miscarriages, and Lord knows it's much harder on her than it is on me. You know, but having faith that there's a plan. You know, and that I don't know what it is. You know, my role is just to continue to show up. You know, and I've been able to be helpful to people who've been through similar circumstances. Not necessarily what I would have wanted. You know, but I'm sure that there's some sort of plan, you know. So, I was really happy. I was kind of looking at the pamphlets and the books that you guys have there, and you guys have the service manual, and that's, you know, I mean, various points in my sobriety. I didn't talk about it a lot, but, you know, the big book has the solutions to all my problems. You know, and the 12 and 12 kind of helps kind of explain some of the, I don't want to say gray area, but, you know, the 6 and 7 steps, a paragraph each, and it really explains it well in the 12 and 12. But, you know, today I go to those 12 concepts, you know, because those are not just for world service, not just for intergroup service, but it applies in your group and it applies in my personal recovery, you know. How to be a leader, you know, is to listen to others, you know, and to be open-minded, you know. And, you know, my life today is so good. On the outside, I have a ton of stuff. You know, I mean, I've had the same job for 10 years. I'm no longer 120 pounds. I have a tie, but I ate the pig and steak, and I don't think I closed my shirt. And, I have a lot of wonderful things. You know, I own a home. I have a nice car. You know, a beautiful wife who's sober. She's going to have, I think, 18 years in the next 2 weeks. And still active in service. And those are nice. But that's not what I came to AA for. I came to AA to be okay with myself and to not drink. And I have that. You know, generally, I'm okay with myself. I don't always act perfect. I still sometimes will bring home, you know, a ream of paper from work or, you know, a couple of pens or something like that. And some of that actually bothers me. You know, which is kind of crazy because I was planning a bank robbery when I got sober. You know, it was a fantasy. You know, it was going to be a solution to my problems. But, you know, my relationship with my family is great. My relationship, you know, with my coworkers is good. You know, guys I sponsor, you know. I'm the good son now. I mean, ironically, you know, my parents call me for help. One of my uncles that I made amends to, one of his daughters, you know, was having a lot of trouble with drinking and drugs, and they called me, you know. And I can't get her sober, but I shared my experience, you know. But, you know, it's an honor and privilege to stand here today. You know, I want to thank you guys for inviting me to speak, and thank you for letting me share.